WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and 5 specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Many in our area are mourning and marking 1 year since October 7th. Hamas killed more than 1,200 people that day and took 250 more hostage, leading to Israeli air and ground attacks that have killed more than 41,000 Palestinians in Gaza. In recent months, the fighting has spread into a regional war. As we reflect on this heartbreaking past year and the violence that continues today, we're checking in with Palestinian and Jewish leaders in our area. What has life been like for them and for their local communities here in the Chicago area? We spoke with 2 rabbis for today's episode. You'll hear first from Michael Schwab, the head rabbi at the North Suburban Synagogue Bethel in Highland Park. He wrote an op-ed in the Chicago Sun-Times, which you can read at suntimes.com. My first question to him was, what is top of mind for him? What is weighing on his heart as we mark 1 year since the Hamas attack and the start of the ensuing war? Here's Rabbi Schwab.
Look, it's a very, very difficult day for anybody who's connected to Israel, and for so many of us in the Jewish community. It really was devastating last year when we kind of were becoming attuned to the unfolding events that happened that day. I personally remember coming into the synagogue as a traditionally observant Jew. I wasn't connected to any media that morning. I walked into synagogue, some of my congregants were there, and I could see in their faces something was terribly wrong. And we learned throughout the rest of the day, 1,200 were murdered and 250 taken hostage. And then we learned all the terrible stories that had happened to so many of these people being taken from their homes, rape, the music festival, where people from all over the world were killed that had no even connection, some of them, to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And today, we're bringing that back up for ourselves. And we're trying to remember the individual people and honor their memory. And at the same time, we're contemplating what this means to Israel and the region, and also to the place of the Jewish community in the United States, because there's been a lot of anti-Semitism, and from the point of view of our community, a lot of misinformation that's been spread about Israel during this time. And so it's a very unsettling, very sad day.
Yeah, this is an international story, but one that many, many Jews have deep personal connections to. You know, for one thing, many have friends and family who are living in Israel, right? I want you to tell us what you want people to understand about what this past year has been like, specifically for your congregation.
It has really affected us emotionally. People have really had lots of moments of feeling deep sadness, real concern that they carry with them on a daily basis throughout the year. It's been a tough year. Many of us have ties to Israel, personal ties. And so we learn about the individual stories, like Hirsch Goldberg Poland, whose family is from Chicago. And he was one of the hostages that was still alive until a month ago, and was one of the 6 that were murdered in the Gazan tunnels. Right before rescue could happen, and we were told that he was going to be slated to be in the next ceasefire deal if there ever is one. And that was extremely tragic and hard for the community. And we this past Sabbath, we call Shabbat, during services, we highlight the life of one hostage that's currently, as far as we know, still alive, to personalize their story so that people remember who they are. They're not just a number. And We did it for somebody who was cousins of somebody in our congregation that was very, very emotional. Most people don't realize that all the people involved, whether they're in Israel or they're in Gaza or Lebanon, there's a trauma that goes along with what's going on there that doesn't just affect the people who are literally killed or injured or wounded, but just by living in that area or being connected. And so I feel like our community has undergone that trauma. And what's made it harder for our community is there's been a huge rise in anti-Semitism. And so somehow for us, and this is just the perspective of the Jewish community, is Israel was invaded, you know, and 1,200 people were murdered. And somehow that sparked more anti-Semitism. We've had bomb threats at our community. We've had, we have to have extra security. And so I think that's added to the anxiety.
Yeah, tell me more about that final point you were making there, like how all of this has changed the way you do your work, or maybe the way that everyday people are praying or coming together.
Absolutely. We are lucky enough to live in a community where the police department is our ally. And but that means that we see police cars in our parking lot quite often for our services and our activities, because they're just as nervous as we are that somebody might want to do our community harm. And we've had to hire armed security to keep ourselves safe during prayer services. We have a preschool. Parents were nervous about sending their kids to an identified Jewish preschool. And so they wanted armed security to be there to protect their children. And this is the reality. If you drove into our parking lot today and you were not a recognized vehicle, security would want to know who you are and why you're there. And these are armed guys, and it's not how we want to operate. I mean, who wants to have people come to pray, you know, and have people with guns like guarding you? That's not something that we thought would be the case in the United States of America, you know, in this year. But this is the reality.
So you wrote in your op-ed, you fear that the Jewish community may stand alone. So many American Jews have said that. They've said that after October 7th, they were hoping for more support from others in their communities, and they just haven't seen that happen. Talk about your experience with that, and if you can expand on the idea that you wrote about of standing alone.
There was a feeling in the Jewish community after October 7th that something terrible happens to our community, and it was clear that Israel was the victim on October 7th on that day, and that people that we had had kind of connections to, organizations that we had partnered with, would, you know, come out and say terrorism is wrong. The killing of civilians in their homes was wrong. The killing of people at a music festival was wrong. And the taking of hostages was wrong. And we stand with Israel or the Jewish community in demanding that the hostages be returned and that Israel be given the latitude to defend itself during this a terrible attack. And I can't answer for anyone else, but it seems that maybe because of the politics of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that maybe people were reticent to say anything about this because they were afraid of making some segment of their community upset. But I'm part of an interfaith group here. I'm part of several other civic organizations. Very few of them were willing to make any public statements about what had happened. And I was surprised. I was surprised and dismayed. And I don't want to disparage anyone because I know that my colleagues, they're wonderful people. And I don't think that they're many of those people meant anything by that. But we didn't get a lot of outreach or, you know, what I would call a hug from too many in the local community. And since then, it's become so politicized that it's almost like the massacre, which is, I think, what it was, that happened on October 7th. Nobody's even talking about it like that anymore.
So as a rabbi, you are an organizational leader. You're also a spiritual leader. So what would you say has been the most challenging aspect of leading people through this time?
think one of the most challenging aspects of leading people through this time is giving people hope. Are we going to believe that things can get better? Are we going to believe that people can start to be more sophisticated about what's happening in Israel and understand, you know, the Middle East a little bit better? Can we have hope that we're not going to deal with flattening identities of people? You know, Israelis are like this, or Jews are like this, and to reduce our conversation to slogans that are hurtful and don't help, and to give people hope that all of this can get better, that anti-Semitism can be combated, that with the right education and the right persistence, we can get back to a place where we can all feel comfortable and secure here, and that even though it's a mess, you know, right now in the Middle East, that we can work through this, we can learn from what happened, and we can make progress.
Mm-hmm. Well, during Rosh Hashanah services last week, you and your co-rabbi, you gave a sermon about having difficult conversations with people who have differing opinions. So tell us more about that and your thinking around that.
Absolutely. My colleague, Rabbi Friedman, and I thought it was really important to speak about how we talk to others who are ideologically opposed to us around something significant, for example, about what's anti-Semitism, what's happening in Israel, or other things. It could be about abortion. It could be about anything. But they're ideologically opposed. It's about something significant. And you want to have some sort of, you want to maintain some sort of relationship with that person, right? How do you do that? We knew that some people, because of the politics divide in the United States, they're having trouble like having family meals together or neighbors, you know, that if you're a home that, you know, I would call them more pro-Israel and your neighbor is quote unquote pro-Palestinian, but you've been friends for, you know, dozens of years, how can you have that conversation, you know, and maintain that relationship? So we thought it was really critical. One, I will say a few things about it if it's okay.
Sure.
In order to have a constructive conversation with somebody, you have to believe that the other person has good intentions. Meaning, you know, if you are consider yourself pro-Palestinian and you're upset with what's happening, you know, Israel's policies about how they're handling the war, it's because you want to preserve life. And it's because you believe innocent people are dying, right? And so somebody who's pro-Israel, they may not like where the blame is being assigned. They may not like the other person's idea of what the solution is, but to recognize the truth of what they're saying is that they're trying to preserve life. They're trying to do what they think is the right thing, to recognize the person's righteous intentions. And each party has to recognize the person's righteous intentions.
Mm-hmm.
And once we have that as a basis, you can go to the next step. And the next step is if you think the other person have righteous intentions, maybe listen to what they're saying. And you don't have to agree with everything they're saying, but find what's true about what they're saying. Because there's no way you're 100% right and they're 100% wrong. And anyway, it's not about being right or wrong. It's about finding the truth. If you're trying to win the debate, then you're never going to have a constructive conversation. It's also about building bridges and developing a deeper relationship mm-hmm. with that person so that you can find common ground. And so if you stop trying to win and you start trying to respect where they're coming from and listen, you might find that there's a little bit of truth that it can help your opinion be stronger and closer to the truth. And maybe they'll actually listen to you and see the truth of what you're saying, because it is both true, for example, in this conflict, that it's devastating that innocent Palestinians are dying. And it is also true that Israelis need to feel like they live in a place where they can be secure and that people aren't going to come over the border and come into their homes and murder them. And that's not a fantasy, a bad fantasy. It's not a nightmare. Mm-hmm. It happened a year ago on October 7th. So I think those truths are both out there.
Yeah.
And the fact that Israel is trying to defend its people, it's complicated. It's an urban warfare. You know, you have a terrorist organization embedding themselves in neighborhood populations. It would be nice for people to at least recognize that that's complicated. It's hard. It's not easy. It's not like there's a base that they can fight against an army and defeat them and leave the civilians out of it. It doesn't work like that. So how is Israel supposed to find the Hamas terrorists?
Yeah.
You know, and maybe Israel isn't doing everything perfect, but maybe there's a recognition that it's complicated, it's complex, and it's not as simple as genocide or murder or the things that are being thrown at Israel.
That's Rabbi Michael Schwab of the North Suburban Synagogue Bethel in Highland Park. Thank you so much for making the time for us. One note before we wrap. You heard Rabbi Schwab disagree that the Israeli military's action in Gaza was genocidal. In March, the UN special rapporteur said there are, quote, reasonable grounds that Israel has committed acts that meet the threshold of genocide. The Israeli government denies that claim. Up next, a different perspective from Rabbi Aryeh Bernstein, who's part of the faculty of Avodah, a progressive organization that centers domestic social justice programming for young Jewish leaders. And note, he is not here representing the organization. He's here speaking as himself. I began by asking him about how he lives here in Hyde Park, but also holds Israeli citizenship. I wanted to know, as someone with a foot in both worlds, how is he processing this moment? Here's Rabbi Bernstein.
Horrified and numbed, and like fighting the numbness all the time at the grotesque and callous disregard for human life.
We've heard from some Jews who feel that the pain of being attacked on October 7th and of the hostages still being in captivity are being overlooked by the world, and the focus is instead on the death toll in Gaza. What's your perspective on that?
I mean, on the contrary, to the extent that there's more focus on the death toll in Gaza, that's because the death toll is so much more massive. The destruction and the displacement are so much more massive and disproportionate. And yet, despite that, the institutional focus on the hostages has been so much more dramatic. I mean, even just look at the Democratic National Convention, where hostage parents, who are actually personal friends whom I love and grieve with, they were invited to speak beautifully at the convention representing that voice. And the Democratic National Committee absolutely put a red line refusal on having any Palestinian of any connection speak at the convention, even an elected official in a swing state with a vetted speech. So I think that's really inaccurate. I think around justice and liberation movements, there's been more focus on the ongoing carnage and war crimes in Gaza because of the massive scale, and that it's ongoing and that we're bankrolling them. You and I.
Last October, you wrote in a column in Jew School, that's a progressive Jewish blog, that, quote, grief can lead to empathy and solidarity, but it can also lead to dehumanization and abuse, end quote. How do you feel about that line 1 year later?
I stand by it. What I was beginning to see already then has played out in really appalling ways that I think people's genuine grief and horror and fear have been very politicized. Politicizing our feelings is not necessarily bad, but they've been politicized toward a very nefarious, dehumanizing goal. And I don't think that people take that as though that's a given. I don't think it is. I really don't think it is. I think that grief and fear lead just as naturally to radical empathy.
You work with young people. I want to hear a little bit about that and how they're grappling with some of these thoughts, these questions.
Yeah, I mean, the population that I work with is mostly like 20s and 30s, young adults, progressive Jews. And increasingly, my personal observation is that people who are very progressive about injustices domestically here are also showing more identification with the plight of the Palestinian people and opposition to ongoing Israeli apartheid. And a lot of the young adult Jews I work with have been really hungry for Jewish spiritual life and communal life, are recognizing that a lot of the assimilation of their ancestors' generations wasn't motivated as much by the positive reasons for secularity as it was by nefarious forces of Christian hegemony and white supremacy and assimilation. And a lot of these people are trying to make a real return to active or observant practicing Jewish life. And they've been in many cases, exiled from Jewish institutions because of their refusal to align themselves with empire and with apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
And in other cases, have just been disgusted by mainstream institutions.
You know, there have also been generational divides and rifts over calls for a ceasefire. I'm curious how that's playing out within your circles.
I think of, you know, one young person I'm in community with who didn't go home for Passover Seder for the first time in her life. I don't know if it's specifically over ceasefire or a broader, that's just the tip of the iceberg mm-hmm. of a broader rift that was too painful. And I know there are many others like that person. I've been lucky. I haven't, in my personal communities and family, things have been much more civil. But I know a lot of people who feel like they have to either times going home to family are times of fighting or of shutting up and complying.
Mm-hmm.
Or pretending to be somebody that they're not, or just hearing all sorts of very dehumanizing and horrific things.
So it's a tense time even within families.
That's what I'm hearing. It hasn't been my personal experience so much, a little bit, but not too much. But I'm hearing that from a lot of people.
Yeah.
For sure.
Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, was last week. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, starts at sundown on Friday. Leave us with this, Rabbi. What lessons are you drawing from the high holidays this year?
We have a lot of repentance to do. I want to be careful about how I say this. We all in the Jewish people have accountability for what are the ways in which, through our communal institutions, we have propped up the machinery of oppression and bloodshed and murder and displacement. So what I really think is that we in the Jewish community have allowed ourselves to get played by Christian hegemonic machinery of war making and profit, who have understood that putting a Jewish face on it helps distract and helps confuse people as to who the root enemy is. That's classic anti-Semitic play. And it's confusing because now, unlike most of history, those who are doing that classic anti-Semitic ploy pretend that they're great friends of the Jews. I don't buy it. And that's something that we have to do repentance for and call on all the bodies of power in this empire to do a massive, massive act of repentance.
That's Rabbi Aryeh Bernstein here speaking not on behalf of his employer, but as himself, a concerned citizen. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts.
Thanks, Sasha.
This podcast was produced and mixed by Linnea Dominic and edited by Dan Tucker. For more conversations like this one, make sure you're subscribed to our podcast wherever you listen and head over to our podcast feed to hear an interview with local Palestinian leader Rami Nashashibi about what he and his community have experienced during the last year. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.